Hi, and welcome to Responsa Radio, where you ask and we answer questions of Jewish law in modern times. I'm Rabbi Avi Killip, Executive Vice President at Hadar, here with Rabbi Ethan Tucker, Rosh Yeshiva at Hadar, a center for higher Jewish learning based in New York City. It's coming, our favorite time of year.
The most wonderful time of year.
Pesach is one of our favorite holidays and provides just so many opportunities to ask halachic questions right and left. So we're excited to bring a couple episodes this year for Pesach Responsa Radio.
We are among the Pesach lovers, Avi, and we are with everyone out there who is in solidarity with us.
Last Pesach was my first ever opportunity going to a Pesach retreat.
Okay.
Where you're completely isolated and spending time only with other people who are celebrating the holiday of Pesach. But that is not the typical way that we celebrate that holiday, right? Most people are figuring out how to observe the holiday of Pesach with all of the intermediate days of Chol HaMoed, the days between the days, the full Chag days, figuring out how to move about the world and how to interact with a world that is not celebrating Pesach.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think of like going to a baseball game as a key Chol HaMoed activity. And then you're out there with the broader world and they're still eating the same stuff that the stadium serves the rest of the year.
And you're eating matzah.
With maybe tuna fish, yeah.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's hard to make a hot dog bun out of matzah.
Very hard. But we try. We try hard.
So this person wrote in with a question about the overlap between exactly that, the avoiding of chametz and interacting with a world that is not avoiding chametz. And we're going to have an added element here, which is how do we respond when people approach us and ask us for money or food, which is actually a whole theme that we get a number of questions about. We've done, I think, two episodes that touch on angles of that question, and this will again.
Yeah, it's really interesting, those places of interaction with the larger world when you're trying to hold to a standard, but you're in a larger world for whom that's not necessarily relevant. So what's the question?
So here's what the questioner writes. This is something that happened to me last Pesach over Chol HaMoed. I was going to a shop, saw someone on the street asking for help, and stopped at the ATM, but it was broken. Purely on autopilot, forgetting it was Pesach, I said the ATM was broken and I didn't have any cash and asked this woman what I could get her, and she said, any sandwich except chicken. I love the detail of this story, right? You can really put yourself in her shoes. So first of all, it's already impressive that this person is going to really great lengths to make sure that she can give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could be perfectly honest and say when I pass someone and I don't have the cash, I don't usually stop at the ATM, never mind stop at the ATM and then try to figure out an alternative solution. And she writes to us in the rest of the question about what she ended up doing and how she tried to approach that she had made an offer to buy someone a sandwich with bread, even though it's Pesach. And I want to share her answer maybe later in the show of what she actually did. And we'll pause here to explore the question. Would it be a problem for her to buy a sandwich with bread to give to someone else? What are the factors she should be considering? And how does this impact our prohibition of interacting with chametz on Pesach?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I feel like I've gotten this question in various forms from different people over the years. And as we said at the beginning, part of what's interesting about it is you are trying to figure out how you be a committed Jew in the world, hold to your standards, but I don't know, not be a jerk or not have to project more than necessary your frame of reference onto everyone else that you're interacting with, particularly in a context of need. So let's dig into what are the categories you kind of have to be concerned about and see where it might lead us in terms of practical guidance. The first thing to just sort of remember is, I think everyone knows you can't eat chametz on Pesach, according to the Torah and all subsequent rabbinic law. But you're also not supposed to own it, right? It just being in your possession is a problem. Ergo, the whole practice of selling chametz, getting it out of your house, all of those different things. And in terms of what we consider to be possession in normal Jewish law, just picking something up is enough to possess something that is currently ownerless or for sale, or certainly giving a seller money in order to acquire something. All of these things generally give you possession of the object. And so on a base level, buying something on Pesach that is chametz is totally out of bounds. You can't do that.
So she's stuck.
That part she seems to be stuck. Even if we can get around that, to also keep in mind, aside from eating and owning, you're also not supposed to get any benefit from chametz on Pesach. And generally, we consider giving something away to someone else and getting some credit for it. And I don't mean monetary credit. I mean sort of human emotional credit. They think of it.
Spiritual olam haba points.
Yeah, that they feel you did them a favor and, you know, you sort of feel good about it. We generally consider that to be a kind of form of benefit as well. And I'll say one added measure of concern is we generally try to keep people away from chametz even when they don't own it, lest they eat it. So even when you sell your chametz or your chametz pots in your own house, the practice is, well, you got to tape that cabinet shut, or you put, you know, paper in front of it or some sign of chametz, don't touch, or something, because it's the kind of food you have no allergy to the rest of the year. And just by autopilot, you would potentially engage with it.
Right. That comes up in this question, actually, where she says, without thinking, I offered that you might, you know, in the middle of the night, without thinking, open the cabinet and eat a cookie, that, you know, therefore tape the cabinet shut so something will stop you.
Yeah. So this question has been asked in different forms over the years. We're going to step away from the person who is hungry, maybe, you know, without a home, looking for you to assist them. But let's just get to what are the analogous cases where Jews were potentially involved in monetary transactions around chametz and a non-Jewish environment. So the first and most central source on this is a response by the Rivash, who is a late medieval North African authority. And he says explicitly, if on Chol HaMoed a non-Jew asks you to buy chametz with their own money, you are not allowed to do it. Okay? In other words, even
with whose own money?
With the non-Jew's own money. So we're going to like an even more extreme case. Like, it's not your chametz. It's not your money. It's just, hey, would you mind going to the store for me with this $20 bill and picking me up a box of Cheerios?
It's like, I'm the intern. I'm just buying my boss's sandwich with my boss's credit card.
Yeah, and this is exactly where it's going to come up in terms of
the ancient intern.
Exactly. Yeah, medieval. The medieval.
Sorry. The medieval.
The late medieval intern. So the Rivash lays out a number of concerns as to why he thinks this is forbidden. The first we touched on already. It's the question of you might eat it, meaning your friend sends you to go buy a roll from the local bakery. On the way home, you might bite off a piece, right? Or just think of it as, oh, he asked me to do it, or, you know, I'm buying a bag of rolls and I can take one of them. So the danger involved in just being near chametz in that way when it's so familiar, that's number one. But the second thing he says is, actually, if you think about the transaction here, the Rivash says the way you should think about it is, even though it's the non-Jew's money, what's really happening is you have this money. You then buy the food from the store. You essentially temporarily own it until you then give it back to the non-Jew. And therefore, in that intervening period, you have owned chametz. You, after all, are going into the store with money, receiving something from the store owner. And in that moment, you're the temporary owner. And that would violate the Torah's ban on you owning chametz.
there's two questions that come up for me in this. One is just to clarify that it doesn't sound like either of these examples are concerned with the touching of chametz, that sometimes people will say like, oh, you're not allowed to touch chametz. That's not actually a thing, right? It's not that you can't touch it. It's these other concerns.
Yeah, that I think is right. And certainly where later people will take this question. I think at this point, it's not totally clear if the Rivash has that bright line. It might be that any touching of chametz is bound up with the concern that you might eat it. But you're correct. Even in that formulation where there's no daylight practically between those categories, they're conceptually different. The problem isn't touching it per se. The problem is touching it might lead you to eat it.
Yeah. Like I'm accidentally touching it or someone threw a piece of bread at me. It's not like, ah, I touched chametz.
Exactly.
I'm in trouble. You know, the other thing that jumps to my mind is whether the technicality of the way that credit cards work should matter. That a credit card charge goes sort of directly from my friend or my boss or whoever else to the store. I'm not actually ever having the money in between.
Yeah. So that is something I think we'll want to explore. Like all halachic discussions, you have foundational texts that issue a ruling and give some basis for it. And then later people are going to come and say, well, if that's your concern, I might be able to address it with this different kind of a variable. So let's go back to that and whether the mode of payment might make a difference in a bit. The first thing I think for the questioner to know and to sort of affirm the questioner's instinct of, oh boy, maybe I'm in trouble here, is this just gets ruled by the Rama, by Rav Moshe Isserles in the Shulchan Aruch. Straight up, it simply says, a Jew may not buy chametz for a non-Jew on Pesach, even if the money is that of the non-Jew, right? Mm-hmm. All the more so if it's your money, because if it's your money, then even more unambiguously, you're acquiring it and then you are handing it over. You might have thought that if the money isn't even mine and I'm just an intermediary, maybe my place in the story can be ignored. But the Rama following the Rivash says no. And that creates a pretty hard default line of how you are supposed to deal with cases like this. There's another angle of concern added by the Magen Avraham, a 17th century Polish commentator on the Shulchan Aruch. And he says, yeah, the Rivash gives you those two reasons, but I'll tell you something else. We know from the laws of idolatrous material or wine used for libations, other kinds of discussions about that in the Talmud, that actually it's forbidden for you to be in a situation with stuff like that where it's obvious that you want the thing to remain intact rather than be destroyed. Even if you're not, it's not yours and you're just sort of watching it, but you have some sort of function where it is important to you that it remain in some viable state, that's a form of getting benefit from it that is inappropriate. And the Magen Avraham says you can kind of copy and paste from the benefit prohibited idolatrous stuff to the benefit prohibited chametz.
So I actually think this is a super interesting element of the laws about chametz. In that it helps us, there's a couple different examples that take us in this direction, but I feel like sometimes the laws of chametz help us understand that responsibility over something is a kind of ownership, that ownership is not just purely things that belong to me, that, you know, chametz that you didn't clean, even if you've said it no longer belongs to me, somehow you're still responsible for it, even though you don't own it. And this is another example of that.
Yeah, and it's exactly right. This is one of the main terms that comes up in all these discussions is achrayut, responsibility. The metric of whether you own it, as it were, for the purposes of violating the Torah's law is ultimately about the question of responsibility. Meaning if, for instance, a non-Jew has left some chametz in your care, were it to be destroyed, you would have to replace it, right? That's a sufficient form of ownership to create a chametz problem, right? So even, you know, sales of chametz, they'll always be structured in a way that it's like, this really belongs to you. It happens to be in my house. I have no access to it. There's no connection between me and the thing, because otherwise a normal thing where someone says, hey, you know, can I leave my bike in your apartment for a couple of days? Can you just watch it? To the extent there's an understanding there that, well, if it were to be stolen or if it were to be ruined, or even if you would be responsible if you went out and wrote it and destroyed it, that is too much of a connection for you to wash your hands of it. So it's interesting to think of other analogs of this. I'll just give you one more case that gives you a sense of how the medieval authorities kind of dealt with this. So you have one case that comes up quoted in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Shimshon, who were brothers from the town of Shans in France. And they deal with a case of a Jew who owns an oven. And basically, like, a non-Jew comes and uses his oven without asking him on Pesach. Mm-hmm. Like, it's some kind of more, you know, public oven owned right. by the Jew. And the Jew didn't authorize anything. And the non-Jew after Pesach says, hey, I used your oven. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to just give you this money, this fee for my use of it. And they say, you can't accept that money.
Yeah.
Because that money itself is kind of making some money, getting benefit off of an item that is prohibited to benefit.
And that's even after the fact.
It's even after the fact, right? We can't set up any situation where you're implicitly benefiting. So not everyone necessarily agrees with that ruling, though it also gets quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. But you see here, it's very easy to get to a place of absolutely not. You may not be involved. You may not get any benefit, monetary, emotional, whatsoever. And indeed, I would say the simple answer to this question is, at least when planning it out in advance, you should avoid being in a situation like this. In other words, yeah, maybe if you anticipate you're going to encounter people in need with this situation,
carry cash.
Have cash, right? Or have something on those days of Chol HaMoed, if we're just talking about planning in advance, because there is no issue, just to be clear where the line gets drawn, there's no issue with giving someone not Jewish money on Pesach, even though you know they will use it to buy a sandwich. Once you've given them the resource that is available to you and it is in their hands, the rest of the story is their story, not yours.
Mm-hmm. It makes me curious. I know I've learned from you that the way that sometimes our food laws actually have sort of an underlying social order that they are pushing us towards. Do you read this as like a push towards you should be spending the holiday of Pesach with other Jews?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. You have that tendency indeed with a lot. We've talked about that, I think, with Shabbat and other contexts. I don't instinctively feel that here, but I do feel a way in which a strict adherence to the laws of Pesach does put you in a kind of different environment and mentality, and in a way, a kind of isolation mentality. Not that you're meant to not be around anyone else, but the laws are going to focus you on this very specific time of year. This is really thinking out loud as you suggest this, avenue of thought. I think it is interesting to consider the idea that, well, what is the Chametz prohibition about? It is something that seems like it is hardwiring us back into our national historical narrative for that week or for those 8 days. The Seder is obviously explicitly about that, but Chametz is about a certain degree of reenacting what did our ancestors eat or not eat at that key moment of historical and religious transition. And when you walk around all week with a very strict boundary around that, you indeed feel like, oh, I have a very different story than all of these other people I'm interacting with.
I actually feel like, right, maybe there's a distinction between saying Chametz pushes you to not interact with non-Jewish people and instead say, actually, Chametz just helps clarify in your life who's Jewish and who's not in a way that when you bring matzah into the workplace, I know many people have the experience of like, oh, quick way to identify who the Jews are because they'll come over and take a piece of matzah from your box. and the non-Jews won't. But I also always find interesting the modern practice of selling your chametz, which actually pushes you to have a relationship with someone not Jewish, right? That's the moment when you get to say, like, okay, who's the non-Jew in my life that I want to sell my chametz to?
That's right. Yeah, it has that really interesting,
effect. Bring them in.
That's right. Right. They have this very important, critical role. So look, there is, as always, as to be expected, a path that goes quite simply from the Rivash to the enshrinement of that point by the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch, forward to contemporary rulings that just say, yeah, you can't do that. So most straight up version of this, Rav Moshe Feinstein is asked about a Jew who works in a non-Jewish bakery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's their job. And they can get off for the days of Yom Tov when it's forbidden to work, but it's too much for them to be off all the days of Chol HaMoed.
Right.
Thinking, you know, this year Pesach falls out on a Tuesday. So by the time you're done with like Sunday being off and the days you would have to take off, well, there's only 2 days left that are Chol HaMoed that aren't Shabbat, Yom Tov, or Sunday. But nonetheless, that's an extra 2 days.
Right.
That's already too much. And particularly, you're talking about someone who doesn't have the option of remote work.
Right.
There's not the same sense of flexibility of hours. So it feels like a very real question, right? And Rav Moshe Feinstein, I don't think he's being, you know, not compassionate. He's just looking at the factors. He says, I don't see how you can do that. Like, you are going to have to find a sub to work in your job. Tell your employer, I got someone to sub for me. But I can't do that because what are you doing sort of on every level? He says it's bad. You're touching the chametz all the time. Again, not because we're worried you're going to touch it, but you're around it. You might eat it. Presumably people who work in the bakery get a free sample every now and then. And you are benefiting from the production and sale of chametz through your job. You, of course, are responsible as a worker on the line for not ruining this or that loaf. So he just says there's nothing to be done. And I think just to pause there for a minute, as we always try to do, there is a reasonability to that approach, which is to say, look, if we take seriously that chametz is something we got to be super on guard about in terms of eating, and we mean it, that you're not allowed to get benefit from it, okay, you can take a job with a bakery, but you have to sort of program in the idea that, but for those 8 days, you're not going to be able to have that job, and let's figure out how we have a sub.
Save your vacation days. That's the moral of the story
here. Right, exactly. And maybe in the end, if you are able to move jobs and you find that too annoying, you'll do something else. That said, I think we can hear the ways in which, you know, you could imagine poskim, at least in various contexts, wanting to explore other avenues here, both practically. What if it's not easy to get another job? What if it feels impossible to find a sub? Again, there's always limits on that. You know, doesn't mean it's just, oh, you can't find another job, you have to work on Shabbat. Like, so no problem, work on Shabbat. But there's a drive. It is Chol HaMoed. It is a day where people are allowed to work when otherwise it would cause great loss to them. And also, I think something that nags at some of the poskim who take up questions like this is my role really significant here? Aren't I a line worker who could be replaced by someone else? And I just took it because it was a job, not because I was really interested in selling bread or being involved in this. Or we talked about the late medieval intern. How about the modern intern whose job is, among other things, to order lunch for people in the office,
right?
And it's one of many tasks that they might do. So there's a drive to explore how we might think about this. So I want to give us one conceptual thought in that direction that maybe we can think about, and then a couple interesting practical rulings that go a different way. So the Chatam Sofer, one of the great modern poskim commentators on the Talmud, he tries to drill down on this question of when is there or is there not a process of shlichut, of being someone else's emissary or not being their emissary. That is to say, when am I unavoidably kind of involved and implicated in a process? And when am I almost an invisible part of that process? And he distinguishes between things that should be understood as a form of shlichut, where you are someone else's proxy in some meaningful way, as opposed to things that he describes using a Talmudic term as ma'aseh kof. Literally, it means like the actions of an ape. But it is a way that captures the idea of sort of automation. Mm-hmm. When are there actions that actually any animal, object moving around, right, could do the same action that I'm doing? My humanity, my intelligence, my consciousness are not per se an important part of the process.
So you'd say, like, if I can set the order on autopilot, or if a robot could put the muffin into the box.
Yeah. So the Chatam Sofer essentially says, look, there are times where you're doing something like sending someone else as your proxy in a court, or to sign over title of your vehicle, and you've given someone power of attorney, right? Well, then that person, their status, your relationship, your connection are very important. There are other times where, yeah, what if I am a messenger bringing something from, you know, one side of town to the other side of town, but it could theoretically just be done by a drone, by a delivery drone. I'm speaking anachronistically mm-hmm. here, right? But in the latter case, he basically says, well, then, of course, your presence is essentially ignorable and you are not really involved in the unfolding events in any meaningful way. So he doesn't take up our case, but this is a sort of background thought that then leads some later people who approach this case to imagine, just as you said, some of the sources that I saw on this don't really point to yet to automation of the level we can now imagine. But if you can imagine the function of the person, right? One of the cases that will come up is, so Rav Chaim David Halevi. Rav Halevi is sitting in Tel Aviv and he's got a question from someone in New York who's living in New York. And he says, listen, it's really hard to find jobs in New York right now. I have a job where one of my tasks is basically transporting chametz stuff and other food things, you know, from warehouses to distribution centers, etc. They're not going to let me take off Chol HaMoed Pesach. They'll fire me.
Yeah.
Not so easy to find another job. What can I do? And part of the exploration Rav Chaim David Halevi does is he says, well, that's not really a job that is requiring, you know, a person to stand with power of attorney to pick up the chametz. This is someone who's been asked to drive a truck, load something, and unload it. And here's the key thing he then adds from our earlier discussion. He says, and because all of the goods are insured, and if the driver were to even lose all that stuff, they would not be responsible, mm-hmm. but the insurance company would pay. There's really no solid basis for saying that this belongs to the driver or is his responsibility in any way. And to the extent he has a responsibility to his job and might be fired, well, that's about not fulfilling his obligations to the job, not per se because he lost these loaves of bread.
So he gets to keep his job.
So he argues in this case, there are enough factors. He should be able to keep that job because we can think about his involvement as being more functional rather than substantive.
Yeah. You know, in our sort of moment of everyone trying to figure out what is AI and what jobs are real
yeah,
and what jobs can and should be replaced by AI or will be, as this sort of texts that help us differentiate between maybe I'm a baker and it's a labor of love. You know, I knead the dough and I figure out, listen for what it's, you know, telling me. And, right. you know, I have this beautiful bakery that I set out every morning versus like, no, I'm just the cracker delivery person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And being sort of a little more attuned to what the nature of the job is. Yeah, I wonder if it'll end up being an interesting or useful proxy if AI could take over the job. Is it intrinsically the kind of job that, you know, doesn't really involve the human agency mm-hmm. responsibility that the chametz laws are getting at? The other piece that gets taken up, which you raised earlier, is, well, who's doing the purchasing? You have another posek, I believe it's Rav Moshe Stern, who says about another worker involved in sort of these kinds of transactions. Well, how are you buying it? Are mm-hmm. you buying the thing with cash? then it's not okay, because then you're really taking ownership of it. If, however, you're buying it with a company check, well, then the company's paying for it, not you.
Yeah.
And it's not even in that interaction, right? Even though the Rama said you can't even buy it for a non-Jew with the non-Jew's money. But he says, yeah, but that makes sense if it's cash, because at the moment when you hand over the money, even if it's the non-Jew's money, it looks like and feels like and it is experienced like a transaction where you've purchased this thing. But if you're signing it over with a company check, right, even though on some level that's still the case of the non-Jew's money being purchased by the Jew, but it's not really the money. You're not holding the money in your hand, and there it really feels more like you are just a functional intermediary, right, between the two things. So, you know, to make a call and put something on the company bill in order to order lunch from a restaurant is different from I'm going to go into a store, buy the sandwich, pick it up, right, and bring it back.
And just to be clear, the distinction here is that it's not your credit card. It's not credit card versus cash, right? Like the story about the oven, the guy who used your oven and you can't accept the money later, that actually seems like a great analog for why your credit card doesn't help. You can't just say, well, the money goes later, so it's fine.
Yeah, it going later doesn't help. But if you wanted to push this line of thinking, you could say, well, actually, what a credit card is asking someone else to pay for something, and you promise to pay them back later. That's, in fact, what a credit card is, right? Mm-hmm. Technically, Visa buys the sandwich. You then promise to pay Visa back.
But that's different than the company card, which is never really my money, and I don't have to pay it back.
That's right. That's even more extreme in that regard. But this is where I'm saying, if you were looking to push cases of need or to justify something that happened, I can imagine the credit card dimension being somewhat significant. I'll give you the last piece here. We have to come back to, but what about you might eat the chametz? Mm-hmm. So Rav Halevi and then Rav Ovadia Yosef.
I like to just imagine the questioner taking a bite of the sandwich before handing it to the person.
I'm not sure how it would go over. but there is an obvious piece here, which maybe our listeners have already intuitively thought of and brought up by some of these later poskim. Well, if everything's wrapped up and you're not dealing actually with just a bunch of rolls, mm-hmm. maybe it's different. And they'll in fact say, you know, earlier, the way people used to buy produce was much more raw, exposed, out in the open. The example I gave before of a box of Cheerios, that is not the way people bought food.
Right.
In a mass-produced cardboard box with a sealed plastic container inside. You've got to be pretty rude to take a bite out of someone's sandwich before you hand it over to them in the first place. But you have to be really unreasonable to actually take something that's wrapped up, open it up, take a bite, put it back in the container, make the person realize that you opened the container. That different material reality, a number of the poskim will say, that just actually creates a different set of guidelines around our concern of whether you're going to come eat this thing.
I think that's right. And I can imagine jobs where, you know, if you're a nanny or a babysitter for kids and you're feeding them crackers, that it would be very reasonable to assume that, like, you eat a cracker in the process, you know, as distinct from something like what you're describing.
Yeah. So can we hear what the person did?
Yeah.
And then we can like review it in light of what we've said.
So here's what our questioner says she did. I got into the shop, panicked, weighed my options, and eventually stopped another person in the shop. I said I was Jewish and buying a sandwich for someone in need, but that I couldn't touch the bread and that I couldn't pay. But could she pick up the sandwich and take it to the self-checkout machine? This is in fact what she did, and I tapped my card on the machine. My helper gave the sandwich to the woman who had asked, and I avoided touching the bread at any point. And I chanted, it's not mine, it's not mine, it's not mine, in my head.
Okay, amazing. The dedication of this person is to be lauded.
Also, she's a great storyteller.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, truth be told, so I don't know, here's my review of the facts. I think there might have been a little too much focus on the I didn't touch it piece, right, on its own. I think we understand where that comes from now, but maybe we can give the questioner a little more context of, well, if it was wrapped up and this and that, like the touching is probably not the issue. But the rest of the way it was handled, actually, it seems intuitively got at a lot of what we were talking about. There was a sense of, well, actually, not my touching it, but my picking it up or directly buying it might implicate me in a way that the mainline sources think is inappropriate. Getting someone else in, to be involved with the actual picking up and handing over definitely creates that barrier. And then the payment itself on some level, particularly if you add the credit card piece, can be understood as, well, you were actually just paying that other person in the shop to do something that you were offering them as, you know, the ability to help this person out. In that sense, I think if this is one of those questions of, do I need to feel guilty in retrospect? I would say no. You should feel good about how you handled it. I think, as we said, when you're setting up a situation like this to begin with, so definitely, as the person had the instinct, giving the person cash who needs something to eat, even if that's not your normal policy, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you're someone who normally buys people who ask for money food, on Pesach, I think it's appropriate and probably the better route to say, on Pesach, I give people money. If you're not in a situation like that, and it feels like there's really no other way to help this person, you know, some variant of what happens here makes sense to me. I think I might feel comfortable in a situation like this, even relying on the sort of credit card functional intermediary theory here to say that you could probably find a way to get that person that sandwich. Maybe you would involve them and say, you know, hey, you know, you want to pick it out, I'll pay, you know, bring them to check out in that way. It's hard to know how every interaction plays out. Of course, there is something beautiful about the possibility of saying, I'd love to help you. It's also actually my holiday where I don't eat bread. We just have to do this a little differently. Is there then a conversation where the person both gets sensitized to the national, you know, historical moment that you're living in, appreciates that you as a Jew are living in a very specific moment, but are nonetheless trying to connect with this other person? That would be beautiful if that could happen. As is always the case with these questions we take on the air, we're never there in the moment, so we can't always predict all the contingencies that might happen.
Yeah. I'll also just echo that there's something beautiful and moving about this person's commitment to mitzvot, all sorts of different mitzvot, and trying to figure out how to hold them together. Wishing everyone a chag kasher v'sameach, a kosher and wonderful holiday.
He set sail and off went he, until he came to a strange country. Looked at the ring, it was pale and worn. His true love was in love with another.
Have a halacha question you'd like answered on the show? Email us at responsaradio@hadar.org. Responsa Radio is a project of the Hadar Institute. Thanks to Jeremy Tabak for producing this podcast and to David Chavinsky for recording and editing this episode.
Go with you forevermore, and I'll beg for my bread from door to door, between the kitchen and the hall.